Hi, and welcome to Revision Media. Here with me, Paul Stevenson. I will be live with you for the next hour, live from London in the UK. This is February 10th, 2021. I'll be with you here for the next hour through till 9 p.m. here in London. 1 p.m. Central Time. It'll be 2 till 3 p.m. Central Time, 3 p.m. to 4 p.m. Eastern Time. Wherever you are around the world, you're very welcome here tonight. Fortunately, we've had very cold weather over here, but in London this morning, it was very bright, very sunny. It was lovely to work in. It was really nice weather. Even though it was -1 or 0 or something like that for most of the day, it was sunny, so it really helped, and it was nice to work in. Not so fortunate up in the north of England and Scotland and places like that, where they've had a hell of a lot of snow. Just to add insult to injury, really, it's just the country is taking a battering. I know we're all experiencing this COVID thing worldwide, but you know, when you think about it, you know, you've had this coronavirus stuff, and you know, under the facade and guise and smokescreen of public health, you've had civil liberties eradicated to levels that you would never have thought possible 14 months ago. The economy is in a complete mess, and the dominoes haven't quite fallen yet there, but that's coming down the tracks, and people are already feeling it. The furlough is going to be extended, which is a joke, because a lot of those companies are just zombie companies. So it's not a case of just the jobs not being there. A lot of those companies who employ those people aren't going to be there. So that's just glorified welfare. There's going to be a long list of people joining the dole queue. There's going to be an expansion of government jobs to provide jobs for those who have had their jobs destroyed in the private sector, having no choice but to perhaps, unless they want to go on the dole, take these public sector jobs and expand the state and its powers. All the while, the diminished taxpaying base is apparently still supposed to fund this expansion of government, as well as, of course, those who are left will probably get taxed to the eyeballs, and you will see a wealth drain out of this country. And the great NHS that they're obsessed with protecting, they should rename it the National COVID Service rather than the National Health Service, because people don't really go there anymore because they're scared of burdening it, or they don't want to catch COVID because of all the hysteria, and people don't get cancer treatments, people don't get operations. It's literally the National COVID Center. It's a socialist organization, anyway, the National Health Service. It's been completely abused, because we've allowed people from Eastern Europe and wherever around the world to come and use it for free at the expense of the taxpayer. The whole idea of it was initially, but this was, of course, this is how the incremental encroaching, the encroachment of socialism operates. It was supposed to be basically for, you know, the largely native white British population when it was created back in the 50s or 60s, as a kind of a backup. So if you're, you know, you pay into it from your taxes, and therefore, you know, when you're sick, you can use it. But we have loads of people abusing and using it now who've never paid into it. They come here from different countries, and from day one, they could use the NHS. But the NHS is a joke. The NHS is overwhelmed every year. Go and look at the mainstream media headlines in 2015, 16, 17, 18. It's overwhelmed. It's at breaking point every year, because you can't invite half the third world in here and half of Eastern Europe in here and expect it to operate when it was set up to basically serve the needs of the previous native population, which was a much lesser population. It's the same with the roads. You know, you invite all these people in here and you wonder why there's all this congestion and pollution. Instead of charging people in London, just don't give all the immigrants who come here the ability to get a license and drive around and clog up the country and the city with their cars. It's not rocket science. Or don't allow them to come here in the first place. Even better is just, how about we actually stop immigration altogether, because it's a small island and it's a joke. The NHS is always overwhelmed. It's not a surprise, but and the roads are congested, and we've got extra pollution because of there's so many additional people in the country. But yeah, the NHS is a joke. It's a socialist organization, institution, really. Free healthcare. If we had proper free market capitalism in the country, everybody could afford private healthcare. Because when you nationalize these types of organizations, on whatever it is, whether it's a building contract, whether it's education, whether it's the hospitals, there is no incentive that you have present in free market capitalism to provide an excellent service. Because otherwise, your customers will vote with their feet. The NHS is a socialist organization. And when you have private enterprise and free market capitalism, rather than people knowing that no matter what they do, for the most part, they're going to get paid and people will still come because it's free. It's all very sloppy. And this, all you end up with is the only constant is mediocrity. Whereas if you have a business, if you're in the business of healthcare, like the private healthcare companies, and people are paying for it, then you need to, you're motivated to provide a superior service. Otherwise, you will not be in business for very long. That's how capitalism works, and it drives down the prices eventually. That's another story. But actually, I might play a clip. Actually, Peter Schiff explains this pretty well in an interview I heard earlier. But anyway, the NHS is a farce. Anyway, it's been a difficult year for everybody, and you know, we've now have all this weather and everything else, and they're destroying people's businesses, and all they can focus on is the coronavirus and the NHS. Like I said, because the NHS is overwhelmed, or because of so many people using the NHS, it's overwhelmed every year. It's just in a normal year, it's not in the government's interest or agenda to focus on it, because people tend to blame whatever government is in power for the struggles that the NHS experiences. And if it's a conservative government, they'll always point at lack of funding, those stingy conservatives. There's nothing conservative about this government. There is no difference between the Labour Party and the Conservative Party. They are all left-leaning, Marxist, globalist, puppet scumbags. Mm. There is no difference in, and there is only a pantomime-like theatre of opposition from the Labour Party. So there is no opposition, and all you get is the criticism of the implementation of the policy. Just this repeated message from Keir Starmer. All you get is that, oh, you didn't lock down soon enough. You should have brought in masks earlier. There's never any real opposition. So people's lives and livelihoods are being destroyed. It's creating increases in depression. I saw a statistic the other day where divorce rates are up by 25%. I guess people are cooped up. They've got their kids there. People are under stress from money, all sorts of things. And this is causing exacerbating probably, you know, any problems that are in a marriage, and probably creating problems that weren't previously there before. All this added stress and strain and anxiety. Much of it, I'm sure, economical. We've had good news over here where the government have said, you know, infections are down, hospitalizations are down, deaths are down. But like I've said before, once you give these people these powers, they're going to do whatever they can to hold on to them. And no more so the case is this highlighted in this little weasel. I don't know how to describe this guy. I consider myself to be reasonably articulate and to be have a reasonable vocabulary. But I don't know. If you watch this guy speaking, it's like he says these things, which are really serious things, in a sort of a non-emotional way. And he just looks up, and he just looks like he just needs to be punched in the face. No, I'm not inciting violence. I said, you know, just because you might think that you would like to do something like that doesn't mean you're going to do it. But this guy is a horrible piece of crap. Matt Hancock. He's a career politician, and he's a little, I don't know, I suspect he's probably a homosexual, and I suspect he's a very nasty individual behind closed doors. Here he is, just as you think there's some good news. This is the latest update here in jolly old England for everyone.
First, Mr. Speaker, we're setting up a new system of hotel quarantine for UK and Irish residents who've been in red list countries in the last 10 days. In short, this means that any returning residents from these countries will have to quarantine in an assigned hotel room for 10 days from the time of arrival. Before they travel, they'll have to book through an online platform and pay for a quarantine package costing £1,750 for an individual travelling alone.
Yeah, you heard that right. So if you want to go on holiday and then come back into the country, you've got to pay £1,750 so that if you test positive for coronavirus, that you can pay for your own quarantine in a hotel. I mean, for 10 days, that's £175 a night. I mean, you can get a very nice hotel for that, but I guarantee you these aren't going to be very nice hotels. He goes on here to say, and you must be isolated in your room. I mean, talk about obliterating the travel industry and sector for a start, and talk about totalitarian, authoritarian policies. I mean, these guys are the same guys who, you know, talk about the evil Hitler for how authoritarian he was. I don't think Hitler's regime was any more authoritarian than these clowns. These little Bolshevik, oh God, these people.
Which includes the hotel, transport and testing. This booking system will be live on Thursday, when we'll also publish the full detailed guidance. Passengers will only be able to enter the UK through a small number of ports that currently account for the vast majority of passenger arrivals.
Now, bearing in mind, you know, if you come across on a dinghy as an illegal immigrant, well, different story. You don't have to worry about paying money. You get your hotel, you get your meals paid for, you don't have to pay any bills, your electricity bills are paid for, and you can do what you want. But, you know, if you're a British citizen or a tax-paying citizen, then no, you've got to pay £1,750 onto your holiday or wherever else it is, and then be stuck in a hotel for 10 days. I mean, this is, you know, when I was talking to my church and or anybody else, this is why people need to have some wisdom or some knowledge of tyranny, because once you give your freedoms away and give your liberties away and give power to psychos like this, they will sit around and dream up as much authoritarian, dictatorial policies that they can think of. They will never let them go. They will always find an excuse. But people don't seem to care. They've enjoyed their freedoms for a while, and they maybe think that the government's going to give it all back to them. They're just a bunch of clowns. This is why democracy is a pile of nonsense, because you have a bunch of uneducated fools who can direct and be responsible for the direction and the government that you have in place, which affects everybody. Not everybody should be voting. They're not qualified to be voting. If you're sitting in front of a television all day watching movies from Hollywood and social engineering soaps all day, and you're like a zombie brainwashed in a trance, you should not be voting. You are going to cause a lot of pain and suffering for a lot of people.
When they arrive, they'll be escorted, which will be closed to guests who aren't quarantining, for 10 days or the longer if they test positive for COVID-19 during their stay. We've contracted 16 hotels for an initial 4,600 rooms, and we will secure more as they're needed. People will need to remain in their rooms and, of course, will not be allowed to mix with other guests.
Yeah, they must remain in their rooms and, of course, not be able to mix with other guests. That sounds lovely, doesn't it? You know, get your £1,750 out, get ready to go. I mean, who the hell wants to do that? I mean, I'm glad I never really go traveling much. I'm not really much of a traveler. But, you know, talk about a disincentivizing someone to go anywhere. You know, yeah, you've got to pay £1,750 to sit in a room, isolate in a room for 10 days with no mixing with other people. I mean, it's like it may as well just be a prison.
And there'll be visible security in place to ensure compliance alongside necessary support.
To ensure compliance. They love that, don't they? Compliance. Well, plenty of compliant people over here. So you probably don't need to be ensuring it. They're just a bunch of zombie robots.
So even as we protect public health, we can look after the people in our care. Second, Mr. Speaker, we're strengthening testing. All passengers are already required to take a pre-departure test and cannot travel to this country if it is positive. From Monday, all international arrivals, whether under home quarantine or hotel quarantine, will be required by law to take further PCR tests on day 2 and day 8 of that quarantine. Passengers will have to book these tests through our online portal before they travel. Anyone planning to travel to the UK from Monday needs to book these tests, and the online portal will go live on Thursday. If either of these post-arrival tests comes back positive, they'll have to quarantine for a further 10 days from the date of the test, and will of course be offered any NHS treatment that's necessary. Any positive result will automatically undergo genomic sequencing to confirm whether they have a variant of concern. Under home quarantining, the existing test release scheme, which my right honourable friend, the Transport Secretary, has built so effectively, can still be used from day 5, but this will be in addition to the 2 mandatory tests. The combination of enhanced testing and sequencing has been a powerful weapon through this pandemic, and we'll be bringing it to bear so we can find positive cases, break the chains of transmission, and prevent new cases and new variants from putting us at risk. And we'll be putting in place tough fines for people who don't comply. This includes a £1,000 penalty for any international arrival.
And wait for it, the best bits yet to come.
Who fails to take a mandatory test. £2,000 penalty to any international arrival who fails to take the second mandatory test, as well as automatically extending their quarantine period to 14 days. And a £5,000 fixed penalty notice, rising to £10,000 for arrivals who fail to quarantine in a designated hotel. We're also coming down hard on people who provide false information on the passenger locator form. Anyone who lies on the passenger locator form and tries to conceal that they've been in a country on the red list in the 10 days before arrival here will face a prison sentence of up to 10 years.
There you have it. That's what a government been out of control sounds like. This little weasel, or anybody who lies, these are the same people who make a living out of lying, can face for lying about, you know, about where they've been or whether they've had a coronavirus, you know, test or not, or whether they've been in a safe country, up to 10,000 years, or sorry, 10 years in prison. You heard that right. You can get up to 10 years in prison for GBH and serious crimes, like assault, burglary, really serious crimes. And now, I don't know, if you happen to be in a country which maybe has a very low coronavirus death toll or whatever, the whole thing's just so amplified and overhyped in the first place, and you try to come into the country and you lie about it, so you avoid the quarantine, well, you can get a nice £2,000 or a £5,000 fine or 10 years in prison. How do we get ourselves in this mess? You know, as I say, I mean, why didn't people say, no, we're not going into lockdown and you're not getting these powers? We now have a situation where it's just we have a small group of people say, you know, just saying constantly what you can and can't do with, you know, with serious things like traveling. And to me, it's symptomatic of your typical sort of communist regime, because they never want anybody leaving. So if you're going to make it, you know, so dangerous and risky to go anywhere, to come back, and so unpleasant, then you don't get people leaving. You don't need to be building walls like they did in, you know, in the Soviet Union and in Eastern Europe between Germany and dividing up Germany. You can keep the little slaves in by these sorts of policies. It shows you, though, when you look at what they can do to restrict people coming into the country, it shows you how easily they could stop mass immigration if the will was there. It's so easy to stop it, isn't it? So you just have some policies which deter people from coming here. Instead, they actually just, you know, punish and intimidate and terrorize and persecute just your average citizen instead. But yeah, we've got education secretaries, we've got transport secretary or ministers. Anything you can think of that you could make a decision for in your own life, you've got a minister for that you pay for. It has to be paid for. I saw a headline earlier. What was it? You know, forget. It was somebody talking about. There's another minister. It was. You know, it's just the point is, the reason that it irritates me so much is when you see these politicians are, you know, in a news clip, you know, the headline, we're a long way off from being able to do that or being able to do that. You know, they get to decide everything, you know. Your whole life is run by these people. Who was it I saw earlier? And it's so sort of deeply accepted now. You know, some guy is responsible for a wide sector, whether it's travel, whether it's health, whether it's whatever. Oh, well, we're a long way off from removing restrictions on that, or, you know, we'll monitor that. You know, they get to decide. This is the farce of democracy. Oh, yeah. This guy here, you know, another weasel, another clown on Sky News, the transport secretary, no quote exact date when Brits can go on holiday. You know, oh, I haven't got an exact date for you. I decide, Brits, when you can go on holiday, when you can't. Give me, you know, check in a couple of weeks and we'll see how we get on. But no exact date yet, you know, before we decide. I mean, this is just like, this is where not only democracy leads to, but this is where brainwashed, brain dead people lead you. And where cowardly churches who won't take a stand for their, apparently they believe in God, so they believe that you're born with certain innate liberties. I mean, remember that guy, that clown? I'm sorry, I just think he is a clown. I don't speak to him anymore because they got my back up so much with their ignorance and or cowardice. I think they had both in abundance. But the pastor I had on my church, trying to look at a passage in Leviticus, which has got nothing to do with anything, you know, talking about how, you know, I was trying to tell him that the government, which the Bible actually affirms, that the role of the government is to keep law and order and to punish criminals. Oh, no, there's a passage here in Leviticus that I found here, I mean, which had nothing to do with some sort of precedent being set for, you know, future roles of government when it comes to public health. But people like that, they could have taken a stand because they could have said, I'm sorry, this is unpopular now, but we don't think this is the role of the state and we don't think this is going to be good for society. And because we, you know, at the time they kept saying, oh, well, we've got to love our neighbor. Well, if you love your neighbor, you'll tell them the truth. You'll do what's good for them, even if they don't like the medicine or the message. If it's good for them, you'll do it. And then if they had taken a stand, people would have realized, oh, you know, 18 months down the line, or maybe already, those guys in the church were right. They saw this coming. They took a stand then because they knew what was coming down the tracks for this, the sort of authoritarian destruction of our liberties that was coming, and the societal problems and the economic problems and the amount of people that are going to die as a result of not being able to get health treatment and operations and cancer scans and everything else is probably going to be way more than, in actual fact, it would be way more, but even way more probably than the 100,000 nonsense figure, manipulated figure that they've put out. But oh no, they couldn't take a stand. They fall for everything and stand for nothing. That's the church. And they just went along with it too. But here, yeah, so we have this guy here, the transport secretary, Grant Shapps, defending the heavy penalties for passengers who give false information at UK borders. But as I say, if you happen to be, you know, an illegal immigrant, you can say, well, I'm a refugee. I've come fleeing persecution from Islam. Don't worry about that. Just come on in. Come on in. It's okay. We don't need your story. Just come on. You know, they don't really seem to be too stringent then. You know, and this under the new measures, anyone who tries to conceal they had been in a, quote, red list country will face up to 10 years in prison. Mr. Sharp described the long jail sentence for those who lie about their travel at the UK border as appropriate. But again, if you happen to be a refugee, apparently, which is really an economic migrant, people, they just ignore the Dublin Declaration and they come straight through. They're supposed to take refuge in the first safe country they come to. Of course, in the Middle East, they never go anywhere else. It's always Europe. It's never Israel. You can be guaranteed of that. Saudi Arabia, no. China, they respect their country and their ethnicity and their culture. So they don't really tolerate too much immigration in there. So they all go to Europe. And they're all fleeing some Zionist wars. The last time I knew, there was no Zionist wars, and the Zionists didn't invade Eritrea or Ghana or wherever, you know. But they lie all the time, and they get here, and once they get their foot in the door, then and if they're ever deported, they just appeal again. So the appeal process, because of these human rights lawyers, it can go on for a lifetime. So once they get here, you have to do an appeal now and again, but life you just go on as normal, really, if you can find some work and some way of fending for yourself, of course. I'm not saying it's like, you know, ideal, but they get looked after well enough. So they're all defending this. I mean, there needs to be a day of reckoning for these scumbags, because this is intolerable. Anyway, let's change the subject. I'm going to play a clip from Peter Schiff. I saw a video we did earlier. The reason I liked it is because the young guys are these days, the millennials, they're quite full of hubris, really, when it comes to, like, you know, economic fundamentals, and they're all into Bitcoin, which is a bubble. And, you know, they can be quite haughty and arrogant because they've made some money in Bitcoin or whatever. And as with comes with youth, there tends to be it accompanies a certain amount of hubris. But this guy, and he's got a lot of followers. He's got like 1.8 million followers. He's a young guy. He's probably only looks like he's in his early 30s. But he's obviously interested in real fundamentals of economics. And he's had Peter Schiff on here. And he asks simple questions, but very helpful questions. And the video is called "Why Are Trade Deficits, Minimum Wage, and Stimulus Checks Bad?" Because, of course, a lot of people think that, you know, particularly minimum wage and the stimulus checks are bad. And Schiff breaks down, you know, why they are bad and why they, you know, are destructive. So we'll play that. It's a change from listening to our little scumbags in our governments.
So if you could, for the layperson, explain why is it bad that maybe we run a trade deficit, and why is it bad, so two-part question, why is it bad that we run a trade deficit? And the other, if price declines are normal, why not run the money printer a little bit and hand out those stimmy checks?
Well, the second question first, well, because doing that prevents prices from falling, and that represents a tax, because now people are denied the benefits of those lower prices. And remember, you know, if the cost of living goes down, if certain things that I'm buying become less expensive, that frees up purchasing power. Now I can spend money in places that I couldn't spend it before. And that's going to relate, you know, result in economic growth in other areas, employment in other areas. So we miss out on all that if the government inflates away those gains. But to go back to your first question about why a trade deficit is bad, I mean, in the short run, it's good in that we live beyond our means, right? We get to consume stuff that we didn't produce, right? Like if you individually were running a deficit personally, meaning that let's say you earned $50,000 a year, but you spent $60,000 or $70,000 a year, right? And you got the difference by, you know, using a credit card or taking out a loan or something like that. So while you are living beyond your means and spending money that you didn't earn, life is good. Right, because you're buying stuff that you really can't afford, right? But now you're asking me, why is that a bad thing? Well, eventually you got to pay back that money, right? And how do you pay back that money? Well, that means that you have to actually start consuming less in the future to make up for the fact that you consumed so much more in the past or, you know, your present. But now you also have to pay the interest on what you borrowed, right? Because you borrowed, you know, now you got to pay the money back with interest. So the trade deficits are simply a reflection of the fact that we are living beyond our means and we are accumulating liabilities, debts to the rest of the world that have to be repaid at a diminished future consumption. Meanwhile, the people who are running trade surpluses, who are producing more than they consume, they get to take those surpluses and invest them and accumulate real assets in America that may generate income. So at the end of the day, Americans, you know, we become serfs in our own country because we sold out all of our assets. In order to consume today, we sell out our productive assets to our creditors. And now they own the real estate. They own the stocks, right? And, you know, we basically sold all the seed corn, and now we're sharecroppers, right? Or, you know, we sold off all our farming equipment and stuff like that. So, look, this is how countries go broke, right? When America was a young country, we did run trade deficits because we took the money and we invested it. We didn't borrow to consume. But we became very rich, and then we were running huge trade surpluses because we were so productive. And that's how we went from being the world's biggest debtor to the world's biggest creditor. It was because we invested all of our trade surpluses and we became really rich. When rich run countries start running deficits, that's how they become poor countries. And we've run deficits for so long that we're already poor. We just don't know it yet.
I mean, I think it's a fascinating argument what you made about basically by preventing consumer prices from falling with the money printing, you're actually hurting poorer people because you're making it harder for people to afford products. Fascinating yes. argument. I mean, you're essentially saying the money printing is a regressive tax on essentially poorer people, where that would be more effective.
Well, absolutely. I mean, it hits the poor, the middle class, the hardest because they don't have the assets that would benefit from inflation, or they don't have the type of debt. Because if you take on debt to buy an asset, right, inflation benefits you by wiping out your debt. You know that from real estate, right? So if you borrow money to buy some rental property, over time, you know, the inflation wipes out the debt that you owe on the property, but you still have the income-producing asset, right? But the poor don't borrow to buy rental property. They borrow to buy a television set. You know, and after a few years, it's, you know, it's not worth very much. Or they borrow to take a vacation, which, you know, once all the money is gone, they borrow to buy clothing. A lot of them borrow to buy gas. They borrow to buy food. Yeah. Right. So, I mean, they're not, you know, benefiting. They're going into debt. But inflation is eroding the value of their paychecks. What they're earning is worth less and less and less as their cost of living goes higher and higher. And if they manage to save some money, if you have some poor people and, you know, they're not in debt, but they have some money in the bank, in a savings account, inflation is just destroying the value of the savings.
Well, how about Biden? He's going to raise the minimum wage, and he thinks that, you know, what we can do is, you know, basically, hey, who cares if we have a bunch of debt now? We'll pay it off with a stronger economy later. What do you say to those two things?
Well, first of all, we're not going to have a stronger economy because of more government spending. We're going to have a weaker economy. What they want to do is not pay off the debt, but repudiate it with inflation, which is what's going to happen, which is like a default, only kind of a stealth default. But all the minimum wage does is make it that much harder for people to lawfully be employed. I mean, that's, if you think about what the minimum wage is, it's the rate that a worker must convince an employer to pay him in order to legally have a job, right? Because everybody, you know, sells their labor, right? If you think about it, each worker is a businessman, and he has one product, you know, his own labor, right? And so you go out in the market and you try to find somebody who wants to buy your labor, right? That wants to give you a paycheck and employ you. Well, you know, what do you have to offer? It's, well, what are your skills, right? When you're a worker and you're going to all these various employers, here's what I can do for you. These are my skills. Here's how much value I can add to your organization. Right. Now, if you have a lot of skills and you can add a lot of value, maybe I can add $20 of value an hour, $30 an hour. Okay. The minimum wage is going to affect me, right? I can get a job. But let's say you're a young kid or even in your mid-20s, but for whatever reason, you just don't have a lot of skills. There's not that much you can do, but you can do something. So let's say you can add $12 worth of value to employers. Okay, well, you have to convince the employer to pay you $15. You ain't getting a job because you only got $12 an hour worth of skills. Now, if there's no minimum wage or the minimum wage is $7.25, you can get a job. But the higher they make the minimum wage, the more people get priced out of the labor market. That's why the best minimum wage is zero, That way nobody gets priced out of the middle. Everybody can get a job. But the beauty of getting a job, and people say, well, how could you live? There's no minimum wage. What if people got a job at $5 an hour?
Right.
Well, that's better than having no job, right? And if you couldn't convince somebody to pay you $6 an hour, it's because five is the most you can get. Because after all, it's a competitive market. If I can deliver $10 an hour worth of value, no one's going to get away with paying me five because somebody else will outbid them and go sit, or I'll work for myself. I mean, nobody forces anybody to take a job. So if you can make more money being self-employed, then you won't work for somebody. You'll work for yourself. The reason you take a job is because you can make more money working for somebody else than you can make working on your own. But the best way, if you only have $5 an hour worth of skills, right? The best way to make $15, $20 an hour in the future is to take that $5 an hour job and then develop skills on the job. That's where you get the best training at a job. That's where you learn. That's where you become more valuable. If you make it illegal for the guy who has $5 an hour worth of skills to get a job because you set the minimum wage at $15, that guy or gal is never getting a job. Which may be the real reason that the government likes the minimum wage is because these people are permanently unemployable. And so the only way they can get money other than crime is by the government giving them welfare. And the government likes that because once they make you dependent on welfare, then you're so afraid of losing that check that you vote for the politicians that are providing the welfare. So it basically is a way for Democrats to guarantee a bunch of voters because they've taken away all their hope of getting a job. And now the only way they can survive is with a government check.
I mean, that's fascinating. I mean, when you look at California, you've got literally 39 million plus people. One third are on Medi-Cal to receive support just to pay for healthcare. And they rely on the government for that purpose, the California government for that purpose. But now the question is, what do you say to somebody who's a single mom in her 30s, divorced, two kids, working two jobs, making the California minimum wage, whatever it is now, 10, 11 bucks an hour, paycheck to paycheck, can't get ahead, doesn't have an extra minute to even watch a TV show, let alone improve her skills. She's not improving her skills to get a better job other than maybe, let's say, working at a restaurant or whatever. What do you say to somebody in a situation like that? Don't they need some support from the government to maybe be able to pump up their bank account a little bit so they can take a shift off and try to study? What's your take?
No, I think the reason that they're struggling is because we've had too much government in the past. What we have to do is free these people from the burden of government. So we need to get rid of their taxes, get rid of the payroll tax, Social Security tax, Medicare tax, get rid of all these rules and regulations that are costing her employer a lot of money that otherwise could have been paid to her in terms of higher wages, but instead it's spent on government regulation. So employers could pay their workers more money if they didn't have to send so much money to the government. But also you mentioned healthcare. The reason healthcare is so expensive is because of the government. If we got the government out of healthcare, the cost would collapse. The same thing with education. The reason that college is so expensive is because of all these government subsidies. Before the government got involved in healthcare and education, they were inexpensive. And the free market is great at making education and healthcare cheaper. Just like it's great at making cell phones cheaper and computers, it brings down the cost of healthcare and improves the quality of healthcare at the same time. The reason it's not happening is because we have all this government involvement. So get the government out of education, get the government out of healthcare, let the free market bring down the cost and bring up the quality, and just have a vibrant free market economy. That is the best thing. What lifts people out of poverty is free market capitalism. All these government promises of more programs and more help, they have never worked. What they do is they impoverish the people that they're trying to lift out of poverty. They make them worse off. That's what happens. I mean, socialism destroys every economy that it infects. It's a disease.
So what do you, you must be vomiting over the idea then that Biden has the power that he has now, suggesting that we are going to make the greatest investments into America over the next year with $3 trillion infrastructure plans, a $1.9 trillion stimulus plan, higher minimum wage. His argument of pumping up this economy so much to basically make our current debt irrelevant because we're going to grow so much. How are we supposed to interpret that?
Well, that's just government spending. Government spending isn't investment. It doesn't grow the economy. You know, these are the same empty promises that the Soviet Union made. Right?
Oh, no.
I mean, they had all these five-year plans. The government's going to do all this and spend. It doesn't work. Government can't invest. Government can't create wealth. Where is that $3 trillion going to come from, or $4 trillion? The government only has what it takes from the private sector. So what Joe Biden is promising is we're going to suck out $3 trillion from the private sector, and we're going to transfer it to government. And the government is going to be a so much better utilizer of capital. We're going to be so much more efficient than the actual private sector owners would have been, that the country is going to benefit from this collective use of these resources. But there is no example in all of history where that has ever worked. I mean, apart from it just defying common sense and all the laws of economics, you can't point to it ever working. But I can point to all these examples of abject failure. Right? And instead of focusing on all the good the government's going to do with the money it takes from the private sector, worry about all the good that's not going to be done by the private sector, because the resources to do that good have been confiscated by the government.
Now, so, I mean, you must certainly cringe at the thought that The Economist reported last month that 25% of all of the currency or money that we have in circulation right now was created in 2020 through stimulus or whatnot throughout, you know, countries throughout the world, because it's not just us. It's Japan's doing QE, essentially. China's doing stimulus. The Eurozone's been doing it. Now, what do you say, though, to the potential that, hey, we could keep printing money if the velocity of money goes down? What if people are becoming more investor savvy or more saver, you know, pay down debt, and maybe they're just not spending as much, and maybe that's not going to lead to higher prices? So maybe we just keep printing.
Well, yeah, you can pretend that that's the case until you're confronted with a crisis. And the problem is, if you do that, it's like, you know, you've got all this rope, but if you fasten it into a noose, you know, and jump, you know, put it right, you're gonna hang. Just because you have a longer rope, but just, you know, as long, if there's enough distance between the limb and, you know, and the ground, right? That's what we've done. We just assume that, oh, okay, we're, you know, we can postpone it, but we can't. And the problem is, once inflation becomes a problem, we have no way to deal with it, because there's only one thing you can do, right? So interest rate and prices really start to rise, right? The Fed says they're comfortable with 2% inflation. Right. Now they say, okay, it's okay if it goes a little bit above. What that is, we're not really sure, you know, because they don't know. But let's say it's 3% and they say, okay, that's not that bad. It's not that far. You know, we were at 1, now we're at 3, it averages out to 2. Then right. It gets to 4, then it gets to 5, 6. At what point, oh my God, it's 6%, it's 7%, we need to do something. Now, if you let inflation get to 6 or 7%, how do you stop it? Well, maybe you have to raise interest rates to 10% or 15%. But well, I mean, we can't even afford 1%. We have so much debt, it's impossible. So once that inflation genie is out of the bottle, we don't have a prayer of putting it back in. And I think that's one of the reasons that the Fed pretends that it wants more inflation is because it knows that it can't do anything about it, right? That's an old saying that if you're being run out of town, you know, get to the head of the crowd and pretend you're leading the parade. And that's what, you know, the Fed wants to do. They want to pretend that, you know, they want inflation. That's a good thing. The reality is it's an awful thing, but they're not going to do anything to protect us from it, because they've set up a situation where in their mind, the cure for inflation is worse than the disease.
So how do you respond to people who say that we are in a deflationary environment because of not only technology, but the flattening of the Phillips curve, where even when we get to this full employment, we're not seeing that those prices go up. Yeah, you know, we go, you know, where we were before, obviously, the recession.
All right, folks, we'll leave it there. That was Peter Schiff. You can listen to that interview on Peter Schiff's website, Peter, of course, is a Jew. Rather ironic. But anyway, they're not all bad. But I'll be back next week, the 17th, same time, Wednesday, the 17th. 2 days before my 45th birthday. Another year is history. And I will be live on Republic Broadcasting Network on Monday at 12 p.m. Central, 1 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Here in the UK. Take care, everyone. Hope you've had a great day. And yeah, God bless you, and be safe in these precarious times, and speak out, speak the truth, and push back on this Bolshevik terrorism. All right, until then, take care.